This is the In Self-Defense Podcast with Don West and Sean Vinson, exploring high-profile self-defense cases and identifying the lessons learned for concealed carriers. Hey, everybody. This is Sean Vincent. Thanks for listening in. I'm excited about the podcast today. Today is the second part of my conversation with Don West. He's CCW Safe National Trial Counsel on the Michael Draca case. So if you remember, Michael Draca is the parking lot shooter out of Clearwater, Florida. He was getting into an argument with Brittany Jacobs over her parking in a handicapped parking spot, a disabled parking spot. Marquise McLaughlin, that's Jacobs' life partner, the father of her children, came out of this convenience store, saw this dude arguing with his girl. He walked up to Draca quickly without notice or warning. He pushed him to the ground violently. Draca pulled his licensed concealed carry pistol. He aimed it at McLaughlin, who was at this point standing over him in kind of an aggressive posture. He paused for a minute. The video shows McLaughlin take a half step back, a real slow retreat, and then he fired. That shot struck McLaughlin in his heart. He stumbled back into the convenience store, fell to the ground, died at the feet of his five-year-old child. At first, there wasn't an arrest. After some more details came out, the prosecutor charged him with manslaughter. A little over a year later, he goes to trial, convicted for manslaughter. Don West and I watched that trial. Had a lot of things to say about it. And in today's podcast, we're going to talk more specifically about the statements that Draca made to police and why, if you're ever approached after a self-defense shooting, you shouldn't say much without the advice of a lawyer. How those statements can be used against you, whether that means you have to testify or not at trial. And we're going to look at, you know, the jurors in this case. In full disclosure, I helped, contributed in a minor way in the jury selection of the Draca case. I helped research the jurors and vet them to make sure that they weren't disqualified for trial. They spoke to the Tampa Bay Times, and they give us some pretty interesting insight into what happened behind the closed doors in the jury room and how they rendered that decision. There's going to be a lot of great lessons for concealed carriers from that. So thanks again for listening in. Here's my conversation with Don West on the Michael Draca trial. So here's one thing that we tell CCW Safe members all the time, and that's after a self-defense shooting, don't make detailed statements to cops without the presence and advice of a lawyer.
Right. Just as a quick refresher, generally speaking, if you're involved in a serious self-defense incident, there will be a responding officer, maybe in response to your own 911 call, which you should keep in mind is being recorded and available as evidence down the road.
Right.
You'll be interacting with a responding officer who will want you to tell him or her what just happened. You will likely be detained. Certainly you'll be detained at the scene for officer safety. You may be detained and taken to the police station for further questioning. You may or may not actually be arrested at that point. We don't need to go into the nuances of that. But it's likely at some point, either that evening or shortly thereafter, a detective with the police agency who's now been fairly recently assigned to the case and getting up to speed.
A homicide detective, yes, will
want to talk with you in detail about what happened. So the general advice is that you provide enough basic information to orient the responding officers. You clearly state that you acted in self-defense because you were attacked, telling them where any evidence that may not be obvious might be, if describing the attacker or attackers, if they fled providing the basic information that helps the police officers know you're not a threat, that you are defending yourself, and then if being requested to provide further information, say you're happy to cooperate, but you want counsel present. Same thing with the detective, where you ask for counsel to be present during any sort of detailed debriefing. And there's lots of reasons for that. Part of it is legal, that why would you subject yourself to the questioning of a trained investigator without having a trained professional helping you? You certainly are clearly at a disadvantage. Secondly, you may very well say things in a way that you don't intend to say because you haven't thought it through, or you felt the need to come up with an answer instead of reflecting on it. And then the trauma of the event itself. You will have undergone a life-threatening circumstance which will affect your judgment and your decision-making. It will affect your perception. And as commonly said, police officers will get a couple, 3 days in between the use of force incident they're involved in until they're asked to be fully debriefed. And that's the recognition of how difficult and how traumatic that experience is and how it can make you unreliable when you're otherwise doing everything possible you can to tell the truth.
Sure, you and I had a chance to talk to Stephen Maddox. That was the CCW SAFE member who was charged and prosecuted. You were instrumental, I think, in his defense, and I got a chance to help pick the jury on that. And Stephen told us that he was trying to answer questions honestly to the investigators there, but he got things wrong, like the number of children that he had or his address, because he was so affected by the attacks that he had endured and the stress of the shooting itself. And he wasn't intentionally trying to deceive, but he got things wrong because he was in a unfamiliar emotional state.
Keep in mind, too, that the investigator has a very clear role in this. They may have already decided that you're guilty. So they may be just looking to confirm things they believe they already know and getting you to try to incriminate yourself. Others may be more genuinely looking for information without having sort of prejudged the situation. But the rules are different. The police can try to trick you and deceive you and lie to you about things during this interrogation process. So if you respond to that, if you become defensive, if you say things that make you look guilty, that's going to be permanently recorded and available to use against you. I really believe that sometimes the hardest job of the defense lawyer representing an innocent person is to
undo what they did.
Yes, yes. And I can think of several cases that I've been involved in or worked on in some capacity where it was an hour or 2 hours or longer into this extended interview before the suspect even knew that the person they had shot had died. That's not a fact that's offered very often, certainly not very early, because they know how that changes the entire picture. And Maddox was one of those. Maddox didn't know for 2 or 3 hours that his attacker was dead.
And man, the Michael Dunn interrogation tape is fascinating, because Michael Dunn felt like he was justified at first, although he knew he messed up by leaving the scene. But there's this point in the tape where he realizes how much trouble he's in, and he's being nice to these guys, these investigators. He's like, "Oh, all of a sudden I don't feel very good." And the homicide detective was like, "Yeah, I bet, because you messed up, dude." But it's that moment where, and I feel like a lot of self-defense defenders feel they were justified, have no doubt to themselves that they were justified, and see the law enforcement as their friends in this. You know, the criminal's the other guy that I had to shoot, and now I'm talking to you like we're bros here, right? You're on the same side because we're both against that bad guy, and then it sinks in potentially later that, oh, wait, I'm the bad guy, or they might be thinking of me as the bad guy because you in fact committed a homicide. But let's look at it in terms of the Draca case. Draca gave pretty extensive videotape statements to law enforcement.
That's right, and they became featured in the trial, of course. So during that interview, he reconstructed the events, even with a demonstration. He answered all of the questions, and if you look at that recording, it appears to me that he was genuinely trying to answer the questions, honestly, from his perspective, that he used some language that the prosecution made a lot to do with, that he said was kind of cop talk.
Cop talk.
And I don't know if that was or not, whether he was trying to act like he was a police officer, but that certainly is a good example of how, or act like a police officer, or just being sure that he was clear in what he was saying. But nonetheless, the prosecution made a heyday out of that, looking for any tiny little thing that could be exploited and turned against him. So and there were lots and lots of those examples.
When you say cop talk, you mean like this, he quotes this 21-foot rule.
The 21-foot rule probably falls into that category. What I was referring to specifically was he might answer a question that would call for a yes or no answer, and he would say negative as opposed to no.
Oh, I got you.
That kind of talk. But since you mentioned the 21-foot rule, that, of course, was also featured in the trial. His comment referenced the 21-foot rule, and the prosecution had a heyday with that and featured an expert witness whose primary purpose, it seems to me, was to make Draca look bad by talking about how Draca was wrong the way he talked about the so-called 21-foot rule.
And the 21-foot rule is mostly for law enforcement, right? It's how far away someone is that they can still get to you in the time it would take you to unholster your weapon, drop the safety, and aim and fire, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I imagine anybody who's taken any kind of self-defense class or probably even a concealed carry class is going to hear about the 21-foot rule. And it's unlikely that they will understand clearly what the research actually was, when it was done, how it was done, what you can draw from it. And over time, and of course, through the mouths of different instructors in different circumstances, it becomes all sorts of things. One of the purposes of calling the expert at the trial against Draca was, I think, to show that Draca misunderstood what the significance of that is. And I think it's arguable, I think it's pretty clear, that the expert got it wrong, or at least the expert focused on some aspect of that that wasn't completely accurate, it wasn't completely forthcoming. Let me just take a second, and I'm certainly no expert on this. I've gathered some information on it. I know generally what you've said, Sean, is correct, and that is that the notion is that if someone is attacking you, that by the time it would take someone to draw a weapon, this is someone that has some skills and some training, to draw a weapon, prepare it to fire, put it on target, and fire it. The actual drill was two times. That person can easily cover about 21 feet. So that means basically if somebody has an edged weapon or a blunt instrument, a baseball bat of some sort, and they're 21 feet or closer in front of you, and they intend to seriously injure or kill you, they can cover that distance in about a second and a half.
Sure, faster than you can get your gun out is the idea if they're inside that circle.
Yeah,
so your decision-making is over at that point.
So the value of knowing that is, generally speaking, someone can be a lot further away than you would think and still get on top of you and kill you before you have an opportunity to defend yourself.
Sure.
And so in general, that's the notion behind it.
And Draco brings this up because he's on the ground on his back and this guy's just feet away from him.
Yes, he's clearly less than 21 feet. And I think what Draco was trying to illustrate is that he was well within that zone of danger. That meant that if McLaughlin intended to come over and kick him in the ribs, kick him in the head, stomp him to death, continue the violence that he had initiated by shoving him to the ground, he was close enough that he could have done that before Draco could defend himself. That's the sense of it.
Yeah, but to get back to your cop talk conversation, you and I have both been involved in cases where the prosecutors have tried to use the defendant's knowledge of self-defense against them, almost as in you know these rules and you're trying to work around them to justify a homicide. Do you agree with that? Am I explaining that properly?
Yeah. Let me back up just a little bit and say that when someone is involved in a self-defense shooting, the jury is asked to look at that incident through the eyes of the shooter, of the defender.
Yeah.
And that includes knowing what the defender knew. And that necessarily incorporates what their training may have been as well, good or bad. It incorporates what they might have known about the attacker. Did they have information beforehand? This guy was violent and aggressive. Did they have a beef? All that kind of stuff is allowed to be looked at by the jury in deciding, was there a fear of great bodily harm or death? And then ultimately, was that fear reasonable under all things known to the defender? So that's where this notion of there's the subjective view of the evidence, and that's through the defender's eyes, as the jury looks at what the defender saw and knew. And then there's this objective view, and that's kind of this reasonable person test. Mm-hmm. The jury looks at it, was it reasonable for him, knowing all that he knew and seeing it as he saw it, to act the way that he did? And I think in large part that's the juror saying, what would I have done if I'd been in that situation? So the training is legitimate. The problem is sometimes it gets exploited, and I think by the prosecutor, and I think that's what happened here. Draco was basically accused by the expert of the state, the prosecutor, of not knowing what he was talking about when he mentioned the 21-foot rule. The prosecutor's expert made a big deal that this research that was done was based upon an edged weapon only, and that McLaughlin didn't have an edged weapon, so nothing that Draco said made sense. I think that's an overly restrictive view, because an edged weapon is a deadly weapon, but so would a baseball bat be at that point, and that doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
Do you care particularly if you're stabbed or hit in the head with a baseball bat? I think not. Both of them are going to do you in. But so I think that was frankly disingenuous. The background is, it's called the Tueller drill. The research was done by Dennis Tueller. I think it goes back to the 80s, trying to understand better what this dynamic was. And the research was duplicated over the years that it became pretty much the standard. That's why it's called the 21-foot rule. And that is that it takes that a person can cover the 21 feet in about a second and a half, which is about the time that it takes to draw and fire a weapon by a trained person. So the mindset is that if the person is 21 feet or closer, that you're in big trouble at that point.
Yeah.
Because once they get their hands on you, if they have a knife or then you're,
but
you're done.
I guess
for
the lesson here is, if you're relying on that rule, and the police investigators are talking to you after a self-defense shooting, that that's something you want to save to talk about with your lawyer. And your lawyer can decide. That's now one of your defenses justifying the shooting. And I think anything that...
I think that's right. I think Draca was inarticulately trying to explain his thinking, trying to reconstruct the events in his mind, and he had heard that from a class or read about it and thought it might help him to throw it in, just like he thought it might help him to talk to a police officer in cop talk, because that's who he was talking to. It wasn't like he was at a cocktail party.
Right.
And those two things backfired in the sense that the prosecutor made hay. And unfortunately, I don't think that the defense lawyers were particularly effective at blunting that or explaining it further. So in a sense, the prosecutors went there and got away with it.
Yeah.
And the jury had sort of a bad taste, I think, about Draca and this picture of who he was. Now, we know that the only picture that the jury got of Draca came from the witnesses that talked about the prior incident when he had threatened a guy over a handicap parking spot, the prior bad act stuff, the witnesses at the scene who described his manner after the fact as almost being matter of fact,
right,
which didn't help very much, and what he said on the statement. He didn't testify.
Yeah, this is what you're leading up to, is they didn't put Draca on the stand to explain to the jurors what his mindset was. They ended up relying on this recorded testimony.
And we could talk for an hour about what's involved in making that decision as a criminal defense lawyer, why somebody testifies, why they don't. Let me say, first of all, that a defendant has the absolute right to testify if they choose. It is their choice and their choice alone. Of course, they would like the guidance of counsel to help them make that choice. But that's not a decision the lawyer can make for them, unlike other legal decisions. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Mr. Draca did not testify was his decision with the counsel and advice of his.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, I think in most cases, the judge will actually address the defendant outside the presence of the jury and ask him if he intends to testify or if he had chosen not to at that point, whether he understood he had the right to, whether it was his decision, whether he needed more time to talk about it, trying to protect the record so that if there's an appeal down the road, that the defendant doesn't come say, well, I didn't know I had the right to testify, or my lawyer told me I wasn't allowed to, those kinds of things, as a fundamental right. But Draca elected not to testify. Now, keep in mind that by the time he would have made that choice, the prosecutor had already decided to offer the recorded interview into evidence.
Right.
They did that during their case, during the prosecution case, and that was their choice. They didn't have to do that.
Sure, and in fact, in Michael Dunn, they waited until the rebuttal argument to play the recording after they were sure that Dunn wasn't going to testify.
Because Mr. Draca voluntarily gave that statement and it was otherwise admissible, it gave the prosecution the choice to play it in their case or not. It was not a choice that the defense had.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you need to emphasize, because you can't just offer pre-recorded stuff about the defendant to evidence if you're the defendant.
That's right. Mr. Draca, in order to get his story in front of the jury, if the prosecution hadn't offered that recorded statement he gave to the police, Mr. Draca would have had to take the stand. Now, that statement could have been used by the prosecution as cross-examination or as impeachment. All or parts of it may possibly have been introduced, but not by Mr. Draca. He doesn't get the opportunity to offer a prior exculpatory yeah. statement into evidence in lieu of his testimony. So a lot of the legal commentators wrestle when they were looking at this case, should the prosecution offer it, or effectively should they force Mr. Draca to take the stand? And that was a strategy decision based upon a number of things. And they would have had to evaluate their case and decided whether they thought it helped them or hurt them.
Well, and then when you look at the contents of that, there's one segment of it where he's recalling to the officer what happened, and his perception was that Marquise McLaughlin, after Draca pulled out the gun, either stayed still or stepped towards him, in direct contrast with what the recording showed. So all of a sudden, you have the defendant making statements that, whether maliciously told or not, are untrue based on the evidence.
They're inaccurate, yes. It's clear that his perception of that was wrong, and it's a question, I suppose, and the prosecutor gets to play with that too. Was he just wrong, and that makes it unreasonable, or was he lying about it, which makes it evidence of guilt? So I assume they figured they could box him in, that since it was evident from the tape that McLaughlin was backing up, I think that's a reasonable construction. When Draca said he wasn't, that he was actually coming forward to him, that puts the prosecutor having his cake and eating it too, because they get to make the reasonableness argument at the end, which they did over and over and over again. I thought it was interesting, too, the way that Draca explained the situation, because when he was challenged a little bit by the interrogator, by the investigating detective, about McLaughlin coming toward him, he actually said to Draca, well, what if there was information that he wasn't coming towards you, that he might actually even be backing up? And Draca said, oh, well, then I wouldn't shoot him. In fact, I wouldn't shoot him, or I couldn't shoot him, even if he was just standing still, much less coming toward me. So in some respects, Draca knew where the boundary was, that had he recognized that McLaughlin had stopped or was retreating, he knew that he would not legally be allowed to use lethal force because the attack was not imminent at that point.
So interesting. And he seemed to me credible when he said that. I believed him.
Yes, I didn't get the usual markers that you look for of somebody that's lying about it and trying to get away with something. No, I believe that's at least the way he was explaining it, that what he thought, and that was sincere. And of course, another interesting dynamic of self-defense is that the threat has to be perceived as real and actual, but it doesn't, in fact, have to be real. That you can be mistaken about certain things as long as your perception of the threat is reasonable and that your response is reasonable. I think where the prosecutor kind of wove the way through this was that they kept pounding on the idea that McLaughlin had stopped and that he had actually taken a step back.
Yeah.
So that not only was there not an actual threat at that moment, but Draca's perception, even if you gave him the benefit of the doubt, was so wrong that it was unreasonable for him to think there was a threat.
That's right. So if you're going to be wrong about a detail, if you're going to misperceive, the jury has to believe that you misperceived it. And
that it was reasonable.
Yeah.
Yes. And I really think that's where they put themselves in the case, where they look at it through your eyes as the defender, but then they also step back and say, what would I have done in that situation? You know, this is an interesting case because there were some jurors. Well, it was interesting because you had the video, and rarely do you have the video that shows the crucial moments leading up to and after mm-hmm. the shooting. But then there was media coverage so you could see it gavel to gavel and see how the lawyers presented this case, their strengths and their weaknesses. You know, I like to armchair quarterback and second guess. So I'm sitting there saying, well, wow, that was pretty good. I'm not sure I could have done it that way. Or, wow, that was terrible. I wish that I was there to ask those questions. Or where I thought evidence was available that wasn't sufficiently developed, especially knowing that he wasn't going to testify.
We'll be right back with more of my conversation with Don West, to include a look inside the jurors' minds and a conversation about whether concealed carriers are compatible with vigilante justice.
We write a lot about, we talk a lot about self-defense. I write for CCW Safe a lot about self-defense, and sometimes I get people who are angry at me or challenge my point of view on some aspect of self-defense and what's justifiable, what's not justifiable. And my answer always is, I'm not telling you what I think. I'm telling you what my experience has been with what juries think. And in the end, if you're a self-defense defender, if you're a self-defense shooter, it doesn't necessarily really matter what you think about whether or not you are justified. It's going to be in the hands of the 6 to 12 people who come from all walks of life and what they think. And in the Draca case, a number of the jurors spoke to reporters afterwards, and that's going to give us a little bit of insight into what they were thinking. And obviously, like, we haven't mentioned this yet, but you know, Draca was convicted of manslaughter after a 6.5-hour jury deliberation. And in my experience, 6.5 hours is not bad. That means that they gave it some real thought.
I think that's a good comment. I think that while there were a handful of witnesses that testified, and certainly a handful of physical exhibits that wound their way in it, this was not a particularly complicated case to unravel. It wasn't a document case where there are thousands of documents to sort through or tons and tons of expert testimony that really mattered much in the scheme of things. So for this jury to deliberate, you know, to just sort through the information, and then the no doubt sometimes agonizing process of trying to figure out what's right, what's lawful, what's fair. Mm-hmm. 6 hours is certainly a tribute to the system working, I think.
Yeah, and so article from the Tampa Bay Times that covered the trial extensively, when they spoke to some jurors, said that it was about 45 minutes to an hour in that they took their first poll, and they said that the jurors were split between guilty and not guilty at that point.
I don't think that's uncommon in a difficult or a close case, and I certainly there's nothing wrong with it. It's encouraged that one of the things the foreperson, once chosen, would do, and once they get settled down and have everything with them and they're ready to start, there's no reason not to take a sort of a preliminary look at how people feel. And then they can start the hard work of people explaining it and people having enough of an open mind that they're willing to, you know, to relook at things or reconsider. And only to comment that sometimes the hardest thing to figure out is how to apply the law to the facts. Once you've got the facts sorted out, the jury's supposed to do that, figure out which witness is believable, what evidence is reliable, and sort of get a handle on what happened. After they do that, they still have to then apply that to the law and figure out whether a crime was committed, and if so, what crime. In a self-defense case, it's not an issue of who committed the crime, but rather was a crime at all committed. And then they've got to dive into the deep end of the law. And as hard as the Supreme Court, who drafted the instructions, and the trial judge, who conformed them to the trial itself, that's no easy task. Those instructions are often very difficult to to truly understand and to apply to a challenging sure. fact
well,
situation.
Case in point, there is one jury question that came out to the judge and to the lawyers, and that was the jury asking for clarification on what reasonable doubt meant. And reasonable doubt, that's the fundamental thing a juror needs to know when they're deciding guilt or innocence, or not guilt or not guilty, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the bottom line, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you and I talked about how we felt about this case, and we put ourselves in a juror's shoes, and we know an awful lot about the law of self-defense. And, you know, you mentioned something that's in the instruction for reasonable doubt, and that's this idea of vacillating, a vacillating conviction. You know what I'm talking about?
You know, let's back up a little bit. Now, this was a criminal trial in Florida, which means that whatever the rules are in Florida are the rules that apply to this case,
right,
as opposed to a federal case that could take place in any federal court around the country where the rules are basically the same. So what I'm saying is every state in their state criminal courts would have their own set of jury instructions that have been crafted over the years by their courts.
Yeah.
And so they are different from state to state. The concept is the same. The reasonable doubt standard is the same. But the language that's used to try to explain it changes. Some's better than others, frankly. The courts, the trial judges, are really, really hesitant to change the language of those core instructions. They basically just read it the way it is and don't deviate from it. And if the jury doesn't quite get it, it's really hard for the judges to do much about that other than just read it again.
Yeah, and that's what happened here. And they said, listen, it's written down. You just got to go figure it out.
So from the reasonable doubt standpoint, I don't have it in front of me, just sort of by memory, having heard it a few times, is that a reasonable doubt is explained in the jury instructions more what it isn't than what it actually is, because how do you actually define it? And there's no easy, clear way of doing it. So one of the instructions that's given is that it's not a forced doubt or a speculative doubt. It's not a possible doubt. The prosecutors love to latch on to it's not a possible doubt, meaning it's possible that you could wake up tomorrow and there could be 6 feet of snow in Florida. Well, yeah, we understand that. But the instructions go on to say, even if you have no reason, let's see, if you have an abiding conviction of guilt, and that's kind of old language, I think. Who uses abiding these days?
The dude.
But nonetheless.
The dude abides. Yeah. For any Lebowski fans out there. But yeah, I get your point.
That's Jeff Bridges' moment in the sun, isn't it? Of course, he has a few.
Sure, but that's our favorite by far. Yeah. So yeah, an abiding conviction.
An abiding conviction of guilt is as close to the instructions as you get them saying, if you believe there is no reasonable doubt. So meaning if you have an abiding conviction of guilt, but one that wavers or vacillates.
Yeah.
Again, pretty old language, the waiver not so much, but vacillates. So if you have an abiding conviction of guilt, but it wavers or vacillates, then you don't have an abiding conviction.
Sure.
So
and it takes...
That's another way of saying that if that's a reasonable doubt, then we know the standard is if there is a reasonable doubt. Some places say a doubt to which you can assign a reason, which is kind of the tail wagging the dog. Mm. But then the jury has this sort of mashup of stuff they take in there and try to figure out what that means and how to apply it to
the law. Well, here's how the jury approached that problem. And, you know, they had that first poll at 45 minutes to an hour in. That meant for the next 5.5 hours, they were hashing it out. One juror said that there's 11 seconds of video surveillance video in this case, they said they rewatched that 11 seconds hundreds and hundreds of times.
Well,
it was the key piece of evidence, obviously.
It sure was. That was, whatever that was, for better or for worse, that's what drove the decision, don't you guess?
I do. And, you know, I like what we talked earlier about the motions in limiting and how the prosecution won the right to show that video in slow motion. But one of the jurors actually says that one of the defense's witnesses talked about how that's not a accurate representation of what happened. So the video they watched over and over again was the full speed video. So I give the jurors a lot of credit for that.
Sure do. That they just didn't sign on to one side or the other from the beginning and run it through. Certainly the prosecution showed it to them because they were allowed to in slow motion, but that the jury was so conscientious that they realized maybe that wasn't the fair thing to do. Maybe that was not the due process that Michael Draca deserved. They didn't, you know, they didn't succumb to that in the jury deliberation room. That's powerful stuff to me, that the system works.
But here's a quote here. It really came down to the fact that once the gun was drawn, he, the victim, retreated. The defendant had enough time to make the decision that once he saw the victim retreating, that he did not have to pull the trigger. And I think, is there any statement that you can think of that defines this case much better than that?
No, that's right on the money. That's the moment of truth, so to speak.
And so, yeah, gosh, it's such a, that kind of takes your breath away, I think, if you're a concealed carrier. And you come to terms with life or death and freedom and prison, right? That it comes down to this pause, right? The sheriff of Pinellas County said that pause gives me pause. That's what kept him from charging or making the arrest originally. But then you get this juror that watches that hundreds of times. And I don't know how many times you've watched it. I've watched it at least 40 times mm-hmm. in my analysis of this. And, you know, there is that moment. That's that moment of reflection. And that's, you know, maybe if he hadn't paused, he has a different case.
How incredible is that, huh? If he had actually fired sooner, nothing else changing, if he had fired sooner, the jury may have felt that he didn't appreciate that McLaughlin was retreating at that point. Now, of course, they may very well have said that he didn't have to fire so fast. He had the situation under control by virtue of displaying the firearm. And then you start getting into the nuances of this so-called 21-foot rule, right? Or how quickly could McLaughlin react to that?
Yeah. Here's another juror, a quote from them that I think is interesting. I think he had the opportunity not to kill him. And that's an interesting thing to think about, right? And that speaks kind of like the duty to retreat or an ability to retreat. The juror says there's an option not to use deadly force here, which is saying that they didn't think that the threat to Draca was imminent or reached the level of force that would justify lethal force, right?
That's a beautiful, beautiful assessment of the case by the juror. It touches on all of these elements of self-defense in a way that is particularly human, if you think about it. With the human, it's in our genes to preserve human life. You preserve your own, but you preserve everyone else's too, as long as you can, that he didn't have to do it. And if you heard the prosecutor say unreasonable or it wasn't reasonable one time, it was said 50 times. And that's this notion that he didn't have to do it, so because he did, it was unreasonable.
Sure. And another part of that is, you know, we're looking at it from the law, but we're also putting ourselves in the shoes of the defender, right?
And you know, I feel bad for McLaughlin. I mean, what a tragedy. A guy, you know, not quite 30 years old, I think, who is shot and killed and no longer on this earth. He has young children. He was in a long-term relationship with Brittany Jacobs. He did some stupid things. He exercised really bad judgment. He was high. But in his mind, he was coming to her rescue. He did it illegally and wrong.
But of course, battery is never punished with executions, right? We don't execute people for battery charges.
Exactly. I also feel bad for Draka, of course, because he made equally bad decisions. He stuck his nose in something that wasn't really his business, at least not in a confrontational way. He could have handled it very differently and still made his point. Sean, I was struck by the testimony that Brittany Jacobs told Draka when he said, "You don't have a parking permit. What are you doing in this parking spot for handicapped?" There were no other people using that spot. There was another one available, I think. And her response was, "My guy or my husband
is
in the store. As soon as he comes out, we will move. There are a couple of young kids." So she wasn't agreeing, but she wasn't being particularly defiant either. She just was saying, "Look, it's just not a big deal because I'm going to move as soon as he comes out." It wasn't like she parked there and left, and there wasn't any immediate use for it. And Draka, that wasn't good enough for him. He didn't say, you know, whatever, and walk away. He continued to escalate it. And of course, that's the problem. You get two confrontational, aggressive guys in something, one that's not hesitant at all to be physical, and the other who's armed, and by the Williams rule, I guess the prior bad act stuff we were talking about, arguably is looking for a reason, you know, itching for something. Man, you've got the makings of a bad outcome, and that's what we had here.
Yeah. Here's something else I want to talk about from another juror. You know, the law says, you know, we have this one who said that she didn't think that it was necessary. He had the opportunity not to shoot, right? And that's not necessarily the legal standard. But, you know, we ask a juror to put themselves in the shoes of the defender, right?
Yes.
And you know, even if we know that he misperceived it, and you talked about before, legally, you're allowed to misperceive it as long as you are honest about that and you're reasonable under that perception to act, right?
Well, that the threat, I guess, rather than perception, should use the threat. The perception of the threat. The threat itself does not have to be real. So in other words, you're allowed to make certain mistakes. Part of that, if you fast forward to the Amber Geiger trial in Dallas, where
sure, she's the one who went into the wrong house and shot the occupant thinking he was a burglar.
That's right. So she made a huge mistake. Her perception of the threat was wrong, but that does not prevent her from mounting an effective self-defense claim. There were other problems in that case, but
which I can't wait to talk to you about, by the way.
Yeah, that's going to be
on another day.
Interesting stuff. The threat doesn't have to be real. The perception of the threat has to be reasonable. So in other words, other people are going to have to say, yeah, I would have seen it like that too.
And here's what this juror said. He said, "I had a hard time seeing what he saw." So here's a juror who watched this 11-second video hundreds of times, and even though Draka gave statements to the police that were recorded and shown to the jury, saying that his, from his point of view, he was moving forward. This juror said, "I just didn't see it. I had a hard time seeing what he saw." It's tough to overcome.
It is. Yes. And I think that juror was being honest with
the way this... Would he say something like, "I had a hard time seeing what he saw," meant that he tried, mm-hmm. right? He tried mm-hmm. to see it the way he did and just couldn't when it came down to it, when he had to make the decision.
In some ways, that gives Draca the benefit of the doubt. That's kind of what this whole notion is, with the prosecution burden having to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. When the juror says, "I tried to see it the way Draca did, but I couldn't," that tells me that he was genuine and sincere in his role as a juror.
Yeah. So going back, we always look for the lessons for the concealed carrier. There's a ton of them in this case. But the ultimate lesson that we always come down to is, I think this one juror said it best, if you have the opportunity not to use lethal force, you got to take it. Legally, you should take it, because that's going to, if a jury thinks you had an opportunity to avoid it, mm-hmm. whether the law says so or not, they may hold that against you.
Yes, that's a fundamental and valuable lesson to learn. That's a direct window into how jurors look at these cases, hard cases. And that's a valuable lesson. There are, of course, lots of other lessons too. And the obvious lesson is, if you're the guy with the gun, you may just want to mind your own business.
Well, isn't that a huge lesson in this? Because, you know, they made hay in the jury, like, although that spot was painted handicapped, it wasn't like an official city designated handicap spot, that she wouldn't have gotten a ticket for parking in that spot. And we talked over and over again that if you are armed, if you choose to carry concealed, then you sort of have an obligation to avoid unnecessary confrontations.
One of the arguments that the prosecutor made, and I thought made it effectively, is that Draca was the guy with the final solution. So he didn't have to care about putting his nose in other people's business or how far he took this thing, because he knew he was equipped with the final solution. That scares the hell out of most jurors, don't you think?
I think so. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, during his recorded statements to cops, I had this quote-unquote cop talk. And we encountered this in Zimmerman. I've seen it before. It gets brought up in some self-defense cases where they project a law enforcement mentality on the defendant. Right? If you're defending your home, that's one thing. But if you're out seeming to be enforcing parking permit law or somehow patrolling a neighborhood, if that was the suggestion, you know, cops are trained to be armed and to approach people who are breaking the law, and citizens are not. So I think if you're armed and a private citizen, and you put yourself in a position where you're encountering a would-be criminal or some code violator, then you're not trained like a cop necessarily. You don't have the legal standing. You're just putting yourself in a potentially no-win scenario.
There are certain hot button descriptions, that words that are just thrown out there because people know the kind of reaction that they cause. And in a firearm incident of some sort, if you throw the word vigilante out there, you've just pushed all those hot buttons that makes everybody
Bristle.
Yes, yes. And that was the word that was used for Zimmerman, of course. And that's the word that comes to mind with Draka. It's easy to paint him as the parking lot vigilante.
Yeah. And
that, you know, that's a lot of ground you have to make up if you're trying to defend that guy, if that name, you know, gets associated with him and sticks. And just like any other scenario where you're having to overcome a negative perception right from the beginning associated with somebody who arms themselves, goes out and sticks their nose into other people's business. There's, by the way, let me say, Draka did nothing illegal except when the jury determined that he committed the crime of manslaughter. Up to that point, he didn't commit any crimes. He just exercised questionable judgment. And it's not against the law to go up to somebody and express your displeasure at the fact that they are parking where they're not supposed to be. You can raise your voice and call them names as long as you're not threatening in some way. But that's all protected by the First Amendment. The first crime in this scenario was committed by Marquise McLaughlin when he shoved Draka to the ground. But that would not have happened, in no way justifying what McLaughlin did, but that would not have happened had Draka just, you know, let it go and backed away. So, anyway.
But that's the thing we talk about. When you are armed and you enter a conflict, you can't control what the other person's going to do. And if, you know, we see these dominoes fall to so many scenarios where the shooting becomes almost inevitable.
You know, there's this expression that one of the guys at CCW Safe used just offhand. I don't know where it came from. We were just talking about some self-defense scenario. I don't remember if it was even in one of the ones in the news, but something that he knew about and we talked about, and he just kind of shook his head and said, "When assholes collide."
Right, yeah.
You know, it's a little descriptive or overly descriptive, but at the same time, man, does it say it all, huh?
Yeah, and you and I have talked about before that when you carry concealed, then you give up your right to be an asshole. If you want to be an asshole, leave the gun at home, right?
Good enough.
I think that's the final word, Don.
One of my favorites.
All right. Thanks again for taking the time to talk.
Enjoyed it, Sean. This has been a fascinating discussion. It's a fascinating case. It's, as you point out, one that you can come at from many different perspectives and learn so much about it. I greatly enjoy talking with you about these cases. It makes me think about stuff I haven't thought about in a long time or thought about in a particular way. And I think whether you're visualizing yourself in a restaurant and wondering who could be coming through the door and how you might react if somebody approaches you in a parking lot trying to figure out what their intentions are, anytime you see something in your mind and discuss it from beginning to end, you're going to come out the other side better prepared to deal with it if it actually happens.
I agree, John. So thanks again for going through that exercise with me.
Take care, Sean. Look forward to the next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.